All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. Welcome to the Manor. I'm the Lord of the Manor, your host, Daniel Elwood, and my co-host is Robert Paul Johnson. You can find his wares at Trubster.com, and tonight he'll be going by the name Upgrade. How are you doing, Upgrade?
Bloody Toff over there, and Wanker. Pretty good, Governor. Yeah. Fancy a spot?
I do, yeah, and I just wanted to throw in the backdrop for this episode tonight of the Actual Anarchy Podcast, episode 190 of the show, actualanarchy.com/190. So we're going to be talking about The Gentleman, which features posh manor estates as a key ingredient in the plot to the film. And so I thought it would only be appropriate. Also, we have Lady Mary Crowley starring in this film tonight.
Oh, shit. What are we going to talk about?
Well, we're going to be talking about The Gentleman and its drug-related nature with one of our many-time guests, Rachel Kennedy of Cannabis Heals Me. And we'll introduce her on the Last Night of Sports and Show in just a moment. But I want to check in with you. How is enforcement of the mask? You mentioned earlier that you've worn a mask twice today. Can you just briefly describe for us what made you bow down and get down on one knee for bend the knee there for the masks?
It all started with a woman, Daniel. Normally, I would not be doing such activities, but should the time come when the thugs that run things decide that their vaginas don't hurt so much and the sand has fallen out of them and they are able to open up the Canadian-U.S. border. Well, I guess the U.S. side is supposedly open, right? But then the Canadians are like, no. Keeping their legs shut tight. So at that point, when they actually do open up, spread wide, I would like to go in to their country and establish relations, you know, diplomatic relations with its occupants. So I had to go and get an enhanced driver's license, which I think is good for boat and driving land entrances into Mexico and Canada. I think it's part of like NAFTA or something like that. But so I had to go to the Department of Licensing, and you have to set up. They just opened the one near me this week. I've been waiting. The other one was 3 hours farther away. They just opened it up this week, and I got an appointment. You have to set up an appointment in order to get in the door. You have to text a number to a phone number, and then they let you in. And you have to be wearing a mask, and you have to sanitize your hands. And they still have the plexiglass things in front of them, and then they're also wearing masks. But, you know, whatever. So I went in there, got it done. And then the second one was when I went into the Walmart, and they have this big sign out front that says, masks are required as per Washington state law. And it's funny because the backside of that exact same sign wasn't that at all. It said something like, please wear a mask, or we recommend you wear a mask because blah, blah, blah. But they clearly have, they've hedged their bets and they got a double-sided mask sign so they could flip it back and forth depending on what their policy is that day. But this one was, we require a mask. And so I took one from the little lady that was standing there. She couldn't be doing anything more productive. I'm sure she was just being the most productive thing, standing there with her masks. And slipped one on and went out and did my shopping. But yeah, those are my two my two capitulations to the thing. But still, the law and the governor Inslee doesn't have the authority to mandate that everyone wear a mask, but he can scare everybody into doing it. And it seems to be working.
Indeed. Well, thank you for sharing your shopping experiences with us here on the Action Anarchy podcast. And we will get into Last Night of Sports in the show right after this with our guest in just a moment. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are The Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Check it out at thelaunchpadmedia.com. Tonight, we're going to be talking about The Gentleman with Rachel Kennerly of Cannabis Heals Me, and this is episode 133 of the show. You can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/133. And Rachel talks about cannabis, and well, this movie happens to have a heck of a lot of it in it. In fact, this is a recommendation by her to do this episode of this movie. And so, of course, we have her back. Welcome back, Rachel. We always have a good time with you. You were on for The Village recently and Instant Family, which we got a really positive review on. So welcome back to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell everyone where they can find what you do?
All right. My name is Rachel Kennerly. I'm the host of the Cannabis Heals Me podcast, which you can find out at cannabishealsme.com. Pleased, as always, to come back to with you guys and talk about stuff from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective.
Well, that is the rumor. That is the rumor about what we do here. And, of course, Robert is here, and we just had Pete Quinones on for Casablanca, and he said that you were a lovely person and a good guest. So,
yeah, and Pete's met me in person, but he doesn't know me that well, so I really need to work on my street cred because, you know, my husband would affirm that I am not that nice.
Well, very good. Well, I find you to be very nice. Now, I usually start out the show with the Google description, so I will do that now. It is The Gentleman, came out in 2019. It's an action/comedy film, 1 hour and 53 minutes. It 7.9 IMDb, 75% Rotten Tomatoes, 51% Metacritic. However, 90% of Google users like it. The description reads, Mickey Pearson is an American expatriate who became rich by building a highly profitable marijuana empire in London. When word gets out that he's looking to cash out of the business, it soon triggers an array of plots and schemes, including bribery and blackmail, from shady characters who want to steal his domain. Came out January 24, 2020, apparently. Director's Guy Ritchie, box office of $115 million on a budget of $22 million. Has many famous types in here, including Matthew McConaughey, Colin Farrell, Hugh Grant, and Lady Mary Crowley, which is what is the reason I have the background image I have here. So, Robert, I'll go to you for your opening information. What do you take away from the Google description? And what do you think about this movie overall? You watched it today, right?
Yeah, it's very fresh in my brain hole. It was fun. It's very, very fun. This is back. This reminds me so much of Snatch and Lockstock. This is like peak Guy Ritchie doing Guy Ritchie stuff. This is like, except you don't have so much of the Edgar Wright type influence of the directing style, but you muted somebody. I don't know what's happening. Anyway, it's very much gangsters doing gangster stuff, and it's not as edgy as his old stuff was, but it's still very, 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 very good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a little bit heavy on the accents. So there was a bit much when I was like, wait, what's happening? Who's saying what? I don't know what, especially when Hugh Grant was talking. But when Colin Farrell was on the screen, he was by far the most fun character. He was just fantastic. I mean, McConaughey was good doing McConaughey stuff, and his consigliere was perfectly fine. He had some good moments too. But really, Colin and his... what were his underlings called? His boys. They were like the toddlers. The toddlers were fantastic. That whole bit, when they started entering the movie, it really took off for me, and I just had a great time.
Yeah, I would agree. And I don't know if it was so much that the accents threw me. It was just the interweaving of the plot and trying to establish where we were and what was actually happening, because there were a couple of fake outs that happened as well that kind of threw things off just a little bit. Like the one that really stood out to me is when they show McConaughey like shooting the guy at the bar, and then they rewind it and like, oh, that actually isn't what happened. And so like, okay, so how much can I trust what I'm seeing going forward? So I kind of had that in the back.
Right. And also the McConaughey fake out death in the beginning too.
Right. Yeah. And it is sort of off screen. So you're sort of like led to believe that, but then since he is our hero, you're like, well, did he really die or did he not? And his consigliere, I'm not saying that right, ends up saving him, of course. Cause yes, you know, indeed. He's like super good. I really enjoyed him. He's Charlie Hunnam, I guess. His name was Ray. I'm not that familiar with him as an actor, but I really enjoyed his just cool collective presence, especially with Hugh Grant. You know, he's like alpha dogging him. Because Hugh Grant is this smarmy, like blackmailer dude who's a little bit shifty and kind of full of himself and thinks it's his time to get his due because he feels like he's put in the time or whatever, but he's still as old as he is and as long as he's been doing this, he's still like kind of like shitty at it. And
yeah, he's real stupid. That's my one main problem. Well, there's two main problems and they all revolve around the Hugh Grant character. One is the narrative and the way it kind of interweaves the story. And just because they keep jumping back to Hugh Grant talking and he's just not the clearest. He's playing this, I don't know, whatever character he's playing, but it just jumps around really quickly with him narrating it. But then also the entire plot of him getting to the juicy nugget of his, you know, big news that he's going to tell, saying that Matthew's the one behind it all. Well, yeah, no shit. It's painfully obvious the whole time that it's Matthew, and for him to think that it's like this big reveal makes him just look like a really stupid character. And now maybe it's hubris, maybe whatever, you can kind of explain it away a little bit. But for me, it took away from the experience. They made it kind of a little bit of a dumber plot, relying on him being so stupid.
Yeah, and now for me, and Rachel will bring you in, I swear, you're our guest. But for me, yeah, that really bothered me that the reveal was it's Matthew's. Like, well, no shit. Obviously, yeah. Like he's the only one who knew.
He showed him where the location was, and the next day, a bunch of guys come and rob the place. Duh.
Right, and I kept waiting for Hugh Grant to like get to a point. He's like, I'm getting to that bit, darling. You know, and even when he did the reveal, it's like, okay, that's it. Like, seriously? Anyway, Rachel, we'll swing it over to you, your take on the good description. And not that we're trying to trash the film right away, but...
I'd expect nothing else from you guys.
I still loved it. It's just the one main thing I didn't like was the Hugh Grant character stupid.
I mean, the Google description seems pretty accurate. And back, you know, in days of yore, when we could actually go to a movie theater and watch a movie, my husband and I actually watched this in the theaters. So it was a nice experience. And I knew right after I watched it, I'm like, okay, I got to talk to this about this with the guys because I thought y'all would probably enjoy it too. But I enjoyed the movie. I liked the action scenes and I thought it was well done. I've never watched any other Guy Ritchie movies, so I didn't really know what to expect going. Well, I knew he was pretty, his stuff was kind of violent, but you know, it was a fun romp, I thought. And I enjoyed Colin Farrell's character a lot. So I think when he came in, that really, it took the film up to the next level. And those guys just brought a little bit of humor. So you had, you know, the action and then it kind of offset with the humor that was in there. So
you got the rap music video in the middle of the movie. What more can you want? It's fantastic.
How did they have time to do that when they were moving all those plants?
Yeah. Well, see, don't ask questions, but yeah, it was pretty cool. And yeah, Guy Ritchie sort of has this irreverent style with a lot of like quick cuts and editing and like these like momentary shots that like zoom in real quick. And it almost is reminiscent of some Quentin Tarantino type stuff, like that same kind of style. And I guess this is, some consider this like the third in a trilogy of his kind of like UK crime romps, like Lock, Stock and then Snatch. And then
you haven't seen Snatch and Lock, Stock, Rachel,
I got to go back and watch.
If you enjoy Gentlemen, you are going to love both of those films.
I have to check them out.
Yeah, he's kind of going back to the well, I think, on this one. Because for a while, he had been doing some other stuff that I think had been sort of falling flat. People weren't really into it. Yeah. Now, remind me, did Guy Ritchie, was he in a relationship or married to Madonna for a time?
Correct.
I think so, yeah.
All right. Well,
during those years, he wasn't really making the gangster movies. I think he was doing more like paycheck stuff. But this one, he was really involved in the story. He was working with seven people, but yeah, the screenplay was written by him and he was heavily involved in the story. So I think this is him getting back to form of what he seems to enjoy and do very well.
Right. And of course, McConaughey is in this and I really enjoy him. The one thing I really noticed with a lot of these guys is that, you know, they're familiar actors. I've known about them for 20 plus years. They all look a hell of a lot older in this movie than in most other movies, even recent stuff. So I don't know if that's just like how they're.
I think that's how they look now. No, they're just like, I'll just take you how you are.
Okay.
You don't have to make it up for this movie.
He's also.
Especially Hugh Grant. He's got serious damage going on.
But Matthew McConaughey is supposed to be like to the point in his life where he wants to retire. He doesn't want to live this gangster life anymore. So it wouldn't make sense for them to try to present this fresh faced Matthew McConaughey that we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
Again, it'll be a little older and a little more grizzled.
Right. Yeah. Now, Rachel, did the plot sort of like make sense the first time you watched it? I almost felt like after watching this, I needed to watch it again, knowing what actually happens to, I don't know, better understand it or like try to pick up some of the nuance into it. I didn't have time to do that. But as my wife and I were watching this, we're like, okay, like, why are we jumping around over here? All right, now what's happening over here? Like, why is it so interweaved? I mean, I kind of get why it is. Like, That's what they're trying to go for, that kind of that, like I said, that Quentin Tarantino thing where the plot kind of folds in on itself and you get all these like crossing over paths and then they all resolve at the end. But it just seemed almost a bit too much going on in such a short amount of time.
Yeah, it definitely isn't a movie that lets you breathe a whole lot, especially in the beginning when they're throwing a lot at you. But go ahead, Rachel. Go ahead.
I think I probably I mean, I enjoyed when I watched it, but it was a little chaotic and a little, it's like, now what? So watching it again, the second time, it was like, okay, that makes sense. Now I get it, you know? So it was a little, but I still enjoyed it. Even the first time around, I still enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. And one of the things I really liked about it was how they're like presenting this problem. Like, okay, how are you going to grow this much product in a country that has very terrible property rights?
Where I didn't catch that the first, well, I didn't catch it as much the first time I watched it, but when I'm watching it, I'm like, wait, what? People can just walk all over your property anytime they want?
Yeah. I don't know how much of that is like accurate, but my wife and I have watched on Netflix, like Nightmare Tenants or something like that. That might not be the name, but it's based in the UK. It's a reality TV show. And it's about these terrible tenants or squatters, and the landlords are like trying to get them out. And squatters get squatters rights. So like if they're there for more than a period of time, you can't kick them out. There's all these like legal proceedings you have to go through. It costs you money. It takes months and months and months. Similarly, like if you want to like renovate a house or build a new house, you have to get council approval. Like the local town council has to approve it.
Some serious commie shit.
Yeah. It's like ridiculous. You know, when you watch this, you're like, holy crap. Like how does anyone ever be a landlord ever? And then you see a movie like this and it's like, oh, people can just like, there's no real private property. And, I think his solution is quite brilliant. And we have, you know, the background I have is, of course, Downton Abbey.
And, the landed gentry.
Right. And these lords and ladies have these manor houses. And in Downton Abbey, they actually, I think they even start talking about it in the later seasons about how it costs so much money to keep these up. And fast forward like 80, 90 years to the gentleman. And yeah, there's a lot of these generations that have, as the patriarchs have died, half the money goes to the state. And then they only have like so much money left over and it's very expensive to keep this up. And so McConaughey comes in and is like, hey, I see you got all this land and you need some money. I've got a solution. And it's brilliant because he can have just a little like above ground spot and then this underground network for his farms, because all the stuff can be apparently run hydroponic and with grow lights and whatnot. And so it's a way to kind of like have it under the nose and you have these lords and ladies and they're a few generations down. So they're like not that, you know, sophisticated anymore. Kind of like running cover for you, political cover for you. It's really kind of it's taking a look at the lay of the land and coming up with a solution within the constraints. And I thought it was really good.
Yeah,
absolutely agree with you.
A comment on the cost of maintaining these houses. When we were in Mississippi, we went to visit Beauvoir, which was a home that Jefferson Davis inherited from a widow. And one of the things, some plaster on some of the ceiling had fallen in this home that was built, you know, however long ago, in the 1800s. And the only person who knows how to do like horsehair plaster in order to restore that ceiling back to its original state is in Paris working on some castle. So I can't even imagine how much that person must cost to come over from Paris to fix this ceiling with horsehair plaster. So you've got the same thing going on in these English castles, I would imagine. Probably maybe even more obscure people that do those crafts, the craftsmen.
Well, and these houses are ginormous and they're hundreds of years old. And like even one example in this was like, oh, we need to replace the roof. And McConaughey's like, well, okay, fine, I'll take care of it. Even though he just got that site shut down, like he couldn't even generate any money from there. So in a way, we've got McConaughey, Mickey Pearson, like being a good guy, like taking care of people who have worked with him. He's got a lot of respect and a lot of honor in what he's doing. And they even bring up the point that eventually this will be legal. And so what this Matthew character is buying is, even though it's going to be legal, he's going to have a head start on all the competition. He's going to have the best growers, the best network of distribution, the best production methods, all of these things. And that was what was being sold. But Robert, I want to get your take on, if we rewind a bit and pretend that the last 2 minutes of conversation didn't happen, like in the movie, I wanted to get your take on his solution within the problems with the property rights being so lax there.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. It's a brilliant solution. You're going to have political cover from all these people that have more of their names and less of their actual wealth. So they have all the kinds of titles, but they are absolutely definitely cash poor. And they have all kinds of political connections, and they're probably in the House of Lords, or at least all their friends are, if they aren't themselves, or their aunts and uncles, or, you know, it's all one giant big group of people. So they're all going to cover for him because they all have an invested interest in doing so. So he's got any number of people he can call if he's ever in a pinch to cover for him for any number of things. It's probably also another way, if he actually did want to go legal, to have all of those connections to ultimately legalize cannabis. But he's probably making way more money having it be illegal, much like the mobsters in Prohibition, with the supply artificially scarce. You can jack up the price way more with far less competition. So he probably likes it the way it is. I mean, he's also a bit of a gangster and like solving his problems with violence. I don't know if he's a perfect moral character in this film. He seems to be operating under decently good intentions most of the time, but some shitty things happen, and he has to have his minions cover up their mistakes. And then, of course, he also kills a few people. But I don't know. We could probably talk about each individual case of death in this movie. But overall, I think you could probably call him kind of like a flawed kind of anti-hero character. And he's definitely in an industry that, of course, should 100% be legal.
Yeah, and by legal, we don't mean like taxed and regulated. We mean decriminalized. Because as we've seen in the U.S. with certain states not decriminalizing, but making it legal, but you need to have a license to be able to grow and a license to sell, and like dramatically high tax rates.
Let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because it's actually ruining.
It's like 90% in Washington state, 90% tax.
Wow. I thought California was bad, because they're like at 40%, I think.
No, it's a terrific. Wow. And go ahead. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, Daniel. But yeah, it's really, really bad. The price you pay at a weed shop in Washington should be, you know, a tenth of what it really is. It's outrageous.
Right. And the other thing that kind of happened with this tax and regulate and having a certain limited number of licenses, these licenses were going for six figures on like the secondary market.
Yeah, they were $1 million a pop.
Yeah, like those taxi medallions in New York, which I got some great stuff on Rothbard about the taxi medallions. And those Uber and Lyft have crushed those. And then that's why the taxi unions have been like trying to shut down them in New York. But back to the cannabis industry, there's a series on Netflix called Murder Mountain. It's about Humboldt County in California. And Rachel, it sounds like maybe you've seen this.
I haven't seen all of it, but I've seen probably about half of it. And it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's interesting. But the thing that really stood out to me was that there was this kind of this industry that was sort of kind of under the nose of the local law enforcement. Like they were outnumbered, and so they couldn't really like impact it all that much. And they would be doing like these like no knock raids and things like that, and like burning down their farms and whatnot. But there were just so many, and it's like such a vast area that they're kind of getting away with it. And a lot of them were old hippies, were like kind of grandfathered in a way. But as soon as it went legal and they tried to conform to the regulations and getting the licenses and all that, there was so much hassle and expense on that end of it. And then so many people were growing, some legal, some illegal, that the market fell out on the selling end. So what they thought was going to be a crop that was going to yield them, you know, like $500,000 might only actually yield them like $100,000. So like they were hitting a huge loss in what their expected return was going to be because they flooded the market with supply and burdened all of these growers with regulations and other burdens that just, you know, prevented them from being profitable. And a lot of them had to shut down as a result. So it was really a better situation before when it was illegal because people could get stuff cheaper and the farms could, you know, afford to do it.
Yeah. And one of the downsides when you go into the legal market, as far as the feds are concerned, your expenses are not deductible. Now, your cost of goods sold are. So if you're a grower, your expenses, a lot of your expenses are going to be deductible for federal income tax purposes. But for if you're a dispensary, especially, the bulk of your costs are not deductible. So that you can actually have a loss for the year and still end up having to pay in federal income tax because your expenses like your rent, insurance, wages at a dispensary, those things are not deductible. So you can have huge losses and still have to pay in on federal income taxes. There have been some cases that have come out where they've challenged the IRS on that. And thus far, they've not been successful in those challenges.
Wow. Okay. And I just know locally around here, there's a lot of like grow ops that have sprung up over the last couple of years, and they have to have like 8-foot high fences, razor wire, cameras, check in, check out, like all of this stuff. And we you know, we drive around, we see them, and we saw them going up, and we see a lot of them shutting down. Mm-hmm. And some of them might be related to the pandemic, but others I think are related to just it's so costly that when the government got involved and quote unquote legalized it, they actually created a nightmare for production and for actually being able to manage within the regulations, because, you know, they're bureaucratically managing this, trying to be this central authority, and it's bound to cause problems.
Well, we know how well central planning works in every other instance.
Yeah, it's almost as if regulations harm business, Daniel. I don't know. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, I'm trying to make that argument. Yeah. And so the whole point of like Mickey selling to this, was it Michael or Matthew?
Matthew.
Once it goes legal, you're going to have a leg up. In a way, yes, he is going to have a leg up, but he's going to have a whole nightmare of problems when it goes legal. Like in my estimation, in watching this film and just kind of the awareness that I have based on watching Murder Mountain and some of the local stuff here, is that that business runs better when it's illegal.
Yeah, I mean, because you don't have to pay all the taxes and you don't have to follow all the regulations. So, and there's a myriad of regulations and they're all different depending on where you're at. You can have, you know, you'll have state, you'll have local. So, I mean, it's just, I feel for anybody that's trying to navigate this environment and try to do it legally. So you know, the people that say, well, you guys told us that if we legalize this, that the black market would go away. And it's like the black market is never going to go away as long as you guys are regulating this and taxing the snot out of it. Because people can't afford to pay double in the dispensary that they can go and get it for on the street.
Indeedly do.
You're here. So let me ask you guys this related to the film. It's sort of a big plot point that McConaughey wants to retire. But by the end, you know, spoilers, everyone, he's like reinvigorated or whatever. And so it just seemed to me like, okay, did he really want to retire? And like, if so, why? Like, it seems like he's got things going pretty well. He could just have let Ray kind of run things and just gone off to the beach with his wife if he had wanted to. It's not like he had to sell to somebody else to enjoy the fruits of what he'd created. And then this whole like Matthew's plot to send Fahook to tell the toddlers to go and break in to like then depress the price of it because of all these problems. And then, oh, it's actually only worth like under $100 million. That just seemed kind of like contrived to me.
Well, he was netting $100 million a year. Why in the world would he sell it for 130? If he can keep it and run it and make 100, why would you sell it for 270,000 less than what it's worth?
Yeah, Robert, did you have issues?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. The retirement angle is weak. They didn't set up that up nearly well enough for my liking. And then the Matthew being so stupid as to hit the one place he was shown, that just seemed like the most obvious dumb move. Like you're acting like your business, this person you're going to go into business with, is just a complete moron if you think you're just going to be able to do that and get away with it. It made the character stupider than they were acting, because they acted like they were talking, they were having conversations, like they were witty, smart individuals, professional businessmen who don't make moves just haphazardly. They're, you know, checking things out thoroughly and they know all the other players in the game. But here they make such stupid moves. It felt like this is a problem that could have been solved in the story writing phase. And they just, maybe they kind of rushed the script out before it was really ready. Not that I didn't really enjoy it. Like, I think Richie is really good at writing fun characters. I don't know if you watch Snatch or Lockstock or this, you'll get the idea that he loves these kind of streetwise tough guys. He writes them very, very well, but I don't know if he writes the best plots. And you know, maybe he needs to collaborate with people that are better at writing plots and better at writing, I don't know, characters that behave in smart ways. But it didn't really hurt my enjoyment too much. I'm still going to give this a really positive review, maybe because I'm a huge Richie fanboy when he's doing this kind of movie. And he's like, if we were to review Lock, Stock, Snatch, and then this would probably be the weakest of the three, but all three would be still really high up in my books as just really fun action, rompy crime adventure movies.
Right. And I'll totally agree with that sentiment. It's like, I'm almost looking at this as like what it could have been. Because it seems like if you had just narrowed down the plot a little bit better and given me a better motivation and not had some of the things kind of just be stupidly done, then this had potential to be that much better. And so I still enjoyed it. I still like really liked the characters and the machinations of the plot, as confusing as it was. And it makes me actually want to watch it again, like I was saying. But at the same time, it's like, it's left a little bit wanting, because you're like, okay, tell me why Matthew McConaughey really wants to retire. Like, show us him having like a bad situation that he's like, I'm getting too old for this shit. You know, like the Murtaugh thing, you know, like I got to walk away while I still can. Or, you know, and why does Matthew, like, why doesn't he just, if he's so savvy and he knows he's going to make a bunch of money, as they discussed all the numbers back of the napkin style, like he knows this is a good deal, even at the $400 million, which it seems as if McConaughey was kind of like fine just almost giving it away. Why didn't Matthew just offer him less? Or conversely, just pay the 400 and be like, I'm going to make 25% return for the next 4 years. I'm going to have all my money back. That's a good investment. Like, why go through this rigmarole of involving this complicated series of dominoes that might lead to the price coming lower without McConaughey realizing who dropped that first domino, which of course obvious to everyone, including the Mickey Pierce character who dropped that first domino.
Yeah. You can have dumb characters doing dumb stuff. Like when the and the toddlers do dumb stuff, you're like, okay, that's no problem. These guys are just dumb athletes that go around, they can beat people up and whatever. And it takes Colin Farrell's character to really keep them, whip them in line and teach them about the world and show them the mistakes that they're making.
Right. But totally believable for them.
Believable. I'm completely on board. Yeah. I mean, they're adults and they're just dumb about the world. They're athletes. But when Mickey Pearson does it and when Matthew does it, and even maybe the Hugh Grant character is probably, you know, he's like caught up in the story and he thinks he's smarter than he really is. I could see that, but there's really no excuse for Pearson or Matthew to be so dumb.
Right. And then also, I forget the guy's name. It's Fahook's boss man.
Dry Eye.
Yeah. Who goes after Lord George. He's trying to be king shit, like all of a sudden, and even like threatening, like, you know, like the old are going to be replaced by the young, and you're just lucky I'm not doing that right now. And then, of course, he does it right now. So, but the whole Dry Eye angle, and then Hugh Grant presenting Dry Eye as this antagonist, that didn't work for me. Like, I didn't see Dry Eye as the main point of conflict with Pearson. Granted, mm-hmm. when he, you know, went to like go after his wife and then all of that, yeah, that's like personal and becomes, I guess you could argue that that makes him the antagonist to Mickey Pearson, but I think it's more Matthew the whole time, of course. You know, Dry is like this nuisance, like this upstart who thinks he's king shit or thinks he's ready to be a come-upper. It's like somebody talking shit to Jordan, you know, some rookie talking shit to Jordan. And then Jordan is swatting the shit out of him, you know?
Yeah, I think Matthew recognized him as a useful tool, but even Matthew was stupid, so I don't know.
Right, because when Dry gets taken out, it's like he's just done, you know? Like, I didn't see Dry Eye really moving things along all that much.
Yeah, what was his plan, essentially? Well, he was just going to muscle out Mickey and take over his business. That was his plan?
Right, and just muscle out Matthew, apparently.
Yeah, but he seemed like, he was in over his head. But I really enjoyed, there were some really great scenes in this film. I mean, plot-wise, I know we're kind of having problems with it, but there were some really great dialogue scenes, and this is what he's good at. There was the scene where Colin Farrell goes in to apologize to the consigliere. I watched that scene three times. I just rewound it and rewound it because I was like, man, the acting is so good. And then the dialogue is so perfect. And then the final scene in the freezer with Dry Eye, the dead body of Dry Eye, and he's talking to Matthew. That whole scene is really well acted and well written. Those are just some fun scenes. And I think this is where he's just having his the most fun as a writer, director, producer guy. Richie just really likes that kind of stuff. So, and it just shows. And I think those scenes kind of save it. And also the relationship between the Hugh Grant character and the consigliere as the story's getting narrated kind of sets the whole tone for the film really well. So, you know, there are problems. It's not a perfect film, but I'd still watch a Guy Ritchie, you know, aging Guy Ritchie film, crime drama, whatever, over some other piece of crap.
With gangsters doing gangster shit.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just gangsters doing gangster shit. It's people with a lot of character and a lot of style. I mean, the relationship with McConaughey and his wife it's probably been done before, but it had a unique kind of spin. She's a very savvy individual, but he's still very, very protective of her. And that all played out, you know, fairly believably. I enjoyed it. I don't know. Do you guys have any issues with him going in and blowing Dry Eye away? I didn't have any issue with that.
No, I'm good with that.
I thought she was a dang good shot, though.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
To pick up that gun and never have used it before and drilled him right here.
Twice. Yeah. Two different people.
Yeah.
I wish I could be that accurate.
And that tiny little gun,
I mean, it's not going to have any recoil, so she probably, but it's got a barrel this long.
And she nailed it, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that, I think she said she had six of the bullets, and I was hoping that she would at least try to reload with Dry Eye. and like have a little bit of a tussle there. But
yeah, I don't know why she played her hand so badly there. Why did she tell him that she had two bullets when there's three guys in there? Why would you tell
them? Said three.
Yeah. I mean, they don't know. Say, I got three bullets in here.
I'm Rambo. I have unlimited ammunition.
Don't even need to reload.
Yeah. So, speaking of the relationship between Mickey Pearson and his wife, the Lady Mary Crowley, I forget her name and her name in the movie. Oh, Roz, right? Mm-hmm. Did it seem weird that somebody who's been married that long would still have that kind of like playing hard to get thing with the husband, and the husband kind of being like still trying to win her over in a way? Like it just seemed weird to me, like that they weren't in that newlywed phase.
Yeah, Rachel, tell us about this.
I don't know. I mean, she didn't seem real happy about him retiring, honestly, because then he was going to be around her shop smoking pot with her mechanic, her only male mechanic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he would be more involved in the movie, too, once we saw Mickey and him hanging out. I thought he would be like, you know, like they'll have like something sort of telegraphed like early on, and then by the end, like, oh, okay, that's why they established that character. But
I thought the shop would play a bigger role in the film, and it really didn't. But I guess it was just the way for Dry Eye to get the meeting with Mickey.
Right. Yeah. By stealing the container of parts.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there were a couple of scenes like he was paying for a 20-foot container and it was a 40-foot. So the guy was like, hey, you need to pay double bubble. And Dry was like, no, this was the deal that you made. And just because you happen to have a 40 container instead of a 20, you still have to pay, or you're still going to, you know, charge me the price that we agreed on. And I think there was like maybe some validity to that. Like, yeah, you kind of came up to an agreement, but it's all like illegal shit. Like he's stealing this entire container. So there's nothing's really above board here. But you can see like, that's why Dry Eye like doesn't give a shit that he's like giving it away to get this audience with Mickey. But that also seems super contrived. Like there's got to be other ways to get the ear of someone when, like, what was Dry even trying to do? Because he like lowballed the offer, right?
Must have been.
I was wondering how, because he kept going click, 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 click. And I didn't count how many clicks, but it's like, that seems like a lot of zeros that he's putting in there.
It sounded like.
I don't know what the offer ended up being, because the movie never said.
He didn't, but he said it was a few zeros short.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe there was a decimal point and then two more zeros that he put in there. You know, he's like going down to the penny.
Yeah. I'll have to rewatch it tonight and count how many times he clicks.
Yeah, you let us know how big of a number that is going to be. But it seems like, I don't understand what Dry was trying to accomplish there. Like he's there making a lowball offer with all these zeros, but it's still a few zeros short. But what was he really trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I don't know.
Did Matthew put him up to that just to kind of throw him off his scent that he was the one that busted in the container?
Well, see, that's the other thing. I'm not sure when this plot got hatched to have the toddlers break in. It seemed to be at that football match where Hugh Grant was taking stills of them and somehow got the stills transcribed into.
No, it was video. It was video.
Oh, okay. Well, that also seemed kind of fucked up. But anyway, then it would be that still from that far away with that big of a lens.
Super shaky. Super shaky. He's holding it in his hand.
Yeah.
You know,
at least have a tripod on there, please. Come on.
But it seemed like maybe that was when the nucleus of the attack on the place was hatched. But well, actually, now I take that back, because that's when Dry was threatening Matthew, right? Mm-hmm. And then Matthew was like, you have no idea what you're in for. Or you're swimming with the big sharks. You've been in the pond for 20 minutes. I've been swimming with the sharks for 20 years. Or whatever he said.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. Guy Ritchie has great dialogue, great lines, great characters, great scenes even.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of like the connecting that's kind of missing a little bit. It's almost like a poor man's Tarantino. Like Tarantino has great dialogue, but he also is very clean with
the story.
The plot works within the plot, you know?
Right. Completely agree. He is, I guess, the British version of Tarantino, and I'd say the slightly inferior version. But I wouldn't say necessarily Ritchie is definitely trying to copy Tarantino. He just has a similar kind of style that has flaws.
Yeah, and the dialogue
everybody's got blind spots.
The dialogue's almost like Kevin Smithian a little bit too.
If Kevin Smith was back in the 90s and British, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, there's a movie called Red State that Kevin Smith did like in 2011 that I want to watch, but it's not available anywhere for streaming. And the DVD is like $80.
Yikes.
But apparently, who owns the rights to it? I don't know. But apparently it's about a right-wing religious church that's trying to impose its morality upon people. And it catfishes these young college students into coming to this woman for sexual escapades. And then they trap these guys and then torture them and make them repent for their sins or whatever. And it's like, it reminded me of just the plot summary. I haven't seen it, but the plot summary reminded me of sort of the idea that you and I growing up thinking we're left-leaning, that we were like for free speech and freedom of association, people could do what they want and get the government out of the bedroom and all this stuff. And it was right wingers like trying to enforce their morality on everyone else and like having these parental advisories on music and other things like that. It seems to be of that mindset. Whereas now, that was maybe 2011, I think. Whereas now it's like totally reversed. You know, now the cancel culture, like we were talking in the pre-show, available for Patreon supports lastnarrative.com/Patreon. We're talking about cancel culture and how with all three of us, like if we hear a good argument, we don't care who it came from. We're, you know, hey, that's a good argument. Even if the rest of their stuff is like garbage, like you were talking about Alex Berenson. He's really great on the pandemic, the COVID stuff, but he's terrible on cannabis, which is your specialty. And he's terrible apparently on the military industrial complex, but we can still look at the thing that he was good on. But in cancel culture now, it's like the body of your work doesn't matter. If you said one wrong thing or did one wrong thing, and that wrong thing might've been invented 10 minutes ago that it is now wrong. And you might've done it 20 years ago. Doesn't matter. You're canceled. You're done.
Yeah.
You know, it's just shifting sands of like what's acceptable. And it's a really bizarre situation. I think Dave Smith and Michael Malice were talking about this recently. And the point was that you can argue with these people and catch them in a contradiction in logic and show it to them, and they just don't fucking care.
No. And I'll say that a lot of people on the right don't either. I think we've, as a culture, as a country, we've lost the ability to reason and to use logic. And if we believe something that isn't logical, we don't care. We're so committed to just sticking with that, that we're never going to admit that we're wrong. I have this issue with a family member that even if you show that what she believes is wrong or not logically consistent with everything else she professes to believe, she's not going to admit that she's wrong. She's going to hold fast to that regardless. And I think it's a problem of the left and the right. I mean, I think the right pretends to care a little bit more about logic, but sometimes you got people that are just trapped in this ideology and they refuse to let it go.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, that kind of brings me back a little bit to the movie. There is one scene in the film where our Mickey Pearson character kind of goes into a ethical tirade against King George. He is... procured a meeting with him somehow, some way. He shows up in his private house or place of business. And he's upset that King George has made this move on him. He's kind of like sussing him out and seeing if this guy is the guy that's actually doing it or not. And in so doing, he kind of talks shit about how King George is unethical because he deals in heroin. Whereas he, Mickey, deals in marijuana, and so there he is virtuous because marijuana is a good drug and heroin's a bad drug, and therefore he's virtuous and King George is immoral. Now, from our perspective, I think both people are running perfectly legitimate operations. Now, obviously, with them having to solve their problems with violence because they can't just go to the cops, that doesn't, I don't excuse that kind of behavior, but in the sense that you are selling a product to somebody who wants to buy it. Now, you could argue, and I'm willing to listen to this argument, that the drug changes a person and makes them weak, and therefore they're addicted and then they want more. In that sense, I would say treatment would be, you know, more required, and not necessarily the person is bad. Or you could say that the person is weak and that they just have an inherent weakness for this drug, and therefore any kind of drug, any kind of substance, they have an addictive personality and they're going to go down into a bad place if they have a steady supply of probably anything necessarily. But if heroin, I mean, clearly heroin has a more, maybe a little bit more addictive, destructive characteristic if you can take it in high doses and whatnot. But from this sense of morality that I come from, there's really no difference in the two substances. You are selling a product to a willing person to purchase. Now, that doesn't mean I would say like, oh, you just go ahead and sell some of this brown stuff to like a four-year-old. I'm not saying that that's a good thing. But if you're selling it to a willing adult voluntarily, then I don't feel that I can step in and say, whoa, 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 stop. I'm going to arrest you two. You two are both bad. And I feel justified in coming in and breaking up this transaction.
Yeah, I'm not sure how threatening people with violence and guns and locking them in cages is really helping the situation. Not to mention the opening the door of all the violations into your privacy, which it was just like the drug war was kind of just like carte blanche to get warrants for wiretaps and looking at your financial records and all of these things. And then they moved it on to the war on terror. And apparently we're now on the war on like the no-see-ums viruses. But yeah, I'll agree that there's nothing that should be monopoly enforced via a state here. But I do think that there is a difference in the potency and the likelihood of people becoming addicted. So like there would be different solutions probably on the market for people who are afflicted by becoming addicted to these things. But I don't think threatening them with violence or locking them in a cage is the solution. So I'll agree with you there. But I do think that Mickey's right in that what he's selling has fewer problems than what Lord George is selling.
But do weak people seek out heroin, or does heroin make you weak? I am not necessarily, that's kind of a chicken and egg answer for me. I'm not 100% sure. It seems to be that if you are looking for a way to escape reality, then heroin or marijuana offers that escape. However, marijuana seems to have a lower, what is it, a threshold? Like you can only get so high, right? But opioids, you can go up to here or up to here. Like you can absorb more of it. Therefore, you can have that overdose activity.
It's because of where the receptors in the brain are for cannabinoids versus like opioids. The receptors, now I'm not a doctor, but a doctor told me this. And what he told me is that the receptors in the brain for like opioids and stuff are in the brainstem that control like breathing and heart and stuff like that, respiration. And the receptors, the receptors for cannabis are not in that part of the brain that control your breathing and your heartbeat. So you're more apt to overdose on those other substances because your respiration can be suppressed to the point where you die. So that's one of the reasons why you've got more deaths with heroin and versus cannabis, which you almost, unless the cannabis is tainted, there have been, I think, zero deaths reported that is just related to cannabis. And the amount of cannabis that you would have to consume in order to die is not physically possible to consume. But have y'all read Johan Hari's book, Chasing the Scream?
I don't know what reading is, but no.
Well, you can listen to it because it's on Audible. I'll send you the Audible link. It's a great book. And one of the things that he looks at in that book is the history of the war on drugs. And then he looks at this one particular case where in, I think, Scotland in the 1980s, there was a doctor who had basically a heroin clinic. And you would think that if people could go and get high anytime they wanted to, that the amount of use of heroin would go up, that crime would go up in this neighborhood. And what they found is the inverse happened, that the heroin use went down and the crime rates went down because the people knew, okay, I don't have to spend my entire life, my entire day trying to figure out how I'm going to get my next hit. I can go to work and then I can go to this place and get the heroin that I need. So there was a woman that was selling her body on the street in order to get money for her heroin. And she was able to actually get a job and provide for her daughter once this heroin clinic opened. But then the government came in and shut it down because the war on drugs, which is led primarily by the United States at that point, they tamped it down. And so the heroin clinic closed, and this lady, not too much longer after that, ended up dead. And who knows what happened to her daughter. But there's an excerpt from his book. You can Google it. It's called The Case for Legal Heroin or something like that. I'll see if I can find the link and send it to you for show notes if you're interested.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that'll go lastnerds.com/133. Also, I heard that Portugal had a decriminalization of drugs and had a positive result from that. Mm-hmm. And then Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute, he has several lectures and does a lot of work in the drug war and legalizing drugs. And I'll post one of those lectures on the show notes page as well, because it's really good.
Yeah, he was just on my show last week, episode 115.
Oh, great.
We were talking about the economics of prohibition and the iron law of prohibition.
Right. And I'm sure he got into like how the purity will be better. And like if it's decriminalized, then you'll have more awareness of what you're buying. There'll be competition for higher quality and lower prices and like safer use and all of those things that kind of go along with an unhampered free market.
Well, one of the arguments that Alex Berenson makes, and he made it an argument in his debate with Jacob Sullum at the Soho Forum. One of the arguments that Alex makes is that demand drives the potency, that the THC percentages of cannabis. And what Mark discovered is that it's government regulation that drives the percentage of, you know, THC and the potency. So that's one of the things that we talked about in our episode, is that, you know, Alex has it completely backwards. And even in these markets where it's opened up and you've got, you know, senior citizens that want cannabis for their arthritis or whatever, they don't want to get stoned. They want to get treatment. They want to not feel bad. So they're looking for low THC, high CBD, high CBG. They don't want to get stoned out of their gourd. They want relief from their pain. So in those markets, we're actually seeing a demand for lower THC percentage, which THC is the psychoactive component of cannabis.
Okay. Yeah, we'll definitely put that on the show notes page, and people can find that at cannabishealsme.com/115. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Very good. Well, we are almost at the time where we need to look into any final notes or any discussion points that anyone wants to bring up, and then we get into the final summary and review. So, Robert, you got anything? You got any,
I took no notes, Daniel. I took zero notes.
Any hot burning questions?
I was too much enjoying the movie film for me to stop and type out the things.
Okay, well, I'll pose one to you then. I have a question. Did the Russian oligarch and the former KGB guy and the threat of the Russian mafia, did it seem believable to you or just shoehorned in? Because it didn't seem like that central to what was going on, but that was the threat that was to Mickey Pearson that we're presented with at the very beginning, where we believe he's dead. That was the Russian mafia hitman guy. But I didn't see any repercussions beyond that. Like, they just kind of like neutralized the Russians very easily, and it was like an afterthought.
Yeah, the Russians got brought up in the, I don't know, at the, when he's getting the Toff's daughter back to her.
Yeah,
and then
it falls out the window and
forgotten until the end of the movie.
Yeah,
it seemed like it was more of a plot convenience and introduced to, I guess, wrap up the thing somehow. But I think you probably could have done a similar kind of thing without the Russians involved at all, because they definitely were an underdeveloped aspect of the plot.
I think it leaves it open for a sequel.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, Mickey's still there doing his thing with this girl.
And now you've got a beef with the Asian mafia and now the Russian mafia. So he's gotten the crosshairs of two Now, I don't know if there'll be a sequel, but I think that plot line kind of leaves it open for a sequel if they want to do it.
And what happened to Matthew? Do we know?
Well, apparently he lived.
Yeah. They kind of insinuated that he got out of the thing with a chunk of flesh out of him.
And that's what Ray is cooking on the grill?
Well, I think that was just a visual metaphor.
I was thinking of that. Okay, is that Matthew? But it happens at the same time as Matthew McConaughey gets in the car to leave. So I don't think it's Matthew's pound of flesh on the grill there.
Right.
I don't think so. Yeah.
But yeah, it's like a visual.
It's a metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think you're right. It does kind of leave an opening for they could expand on this universe. And you've got Asian Gang, though he kind of like wiped out all the main players there.
Yeah. But there was still a guy over Dry Eye, because Dry Eye is like this, whoever this guy was,
his uncle.
Yeah. So there's still somebody over him.
Well, it would be fun, although Guy Ritchie is not known for doing sequels, but he does do similar type of projects. So who knows? But I think you're right. You could do another film in this universe quite easily.
Yeah. Maybe tie up some of these loose ends in these plot. They're not necessarily holes.
Explain why they're so stupid.
Yeah.
Explain why they had other reasons to believe what they seemingly believe.
And how are they so successful if they were so foolish?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
there's a fun scene though. When Colin Farrell's just, the whole movie is just great. When he abducts the news guy and he's showing the video he made to the consigliere, and he's like, oh yeah, it's nightmare fuel. He cannot unsee this. That was so fun. What a great scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. It changes you. You'll never be the same after seeing this.
They just gave you the audio from the video. And his inhibitions were down, but he knew it was a pig.
Yeah. So. I wouldn't have picked that one.
All right. Well, let's get into a final summary review. Robert, if you'd like to lead us off.
Well, this is just another fun Guy Ritchie film back in his traditional old style that first got him famous with Lock, Stock, and Snatch. That's where I first found out about the guy. And then he went on to do a whole lot of work for Hollywood that is forgettable. I think he did the Aladdin reboot. I think he just all kinds of crap just to make a living. No shame in that. No shame in earning a living, support the family. You know, I'm sure Madonna eats a lot. So, you know, whatever, but I'm glad he got back to do this. And he did a few other films that were pretty decent, but those are the main three that I know him for, that I enjoy his work the most in. And we've kind of talked all the issues that I have and all the ways he probably could have done it a little bit better, but I'll still take it. I still think this is like a solid 8. Fantastic. Colin Farrell just killing it. Just such a joy to watch on screen. Him and the consigliere had a really nice dynamic. If there is a sequel, I would definitely want to see him in it. So maybe even focusing in on him. I don't know. Getting drawn back into the criminal underworld, even though he thought he was out. I'm sure you could go any number of ways with it, but this was just a whole lot of fun. I didn't even stop and write notes. It's just a lot of gangsters doing gangster shit, which is usually bad. It usually makes for a boring episode of The Last Nighters. Not that there's ever a boring episode, but it just means that there's just, you know, less content to dig in. Who's the protagonist? I don't know. They're all shitty. But this is just, he comes up with fun, you know, ways things go wrong. And then how do you solve them? And they come up with creative solutions. And the status world that we live in, with marijuana being illegal in a lot of places still, leaves for creative solutions for budding entrepreneurs. And like we talked about, maybe more people should not go along with all this ridiculous government regulation and taxation and just get to the business of providing a product for your customers. But the film is a strong 8. Highly recommend it. I also recommend Snatch and Lock, Stock if you have not seen it. Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, and Snatch, with probably one of my favorite Brad Pitt performances of all time. Fantastic stuff. Check it out.
Is that higher than the Fight Club performance or lower?
It's higher in the performance, although he's not in the film for as long. So, and he's doing this like heavy pikey accent. So you're like, I don't know, what is he even saying? So they're both really, really good. He plays this bare knuckle boxer gypsy character, and it's just a lot of fun. So I don't know. It's all good. I don't know. What would you call this trilogy? Can't be just the Guy Ritchie trilogy. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a little boring. I mean, the Simon Pegg's got the cornetto, so we got to come up with a name for this.
Yeah.
But anyway, Rachel, let's get your final summary and your score. It can be, you know, however you want to score it. It doesn't have to be numbers. It could be stars. It could be little marijuana leaves, however many.
Well, I'll be consistent with Robert, and I'll say I probably give this one an 8 as well. I didn't buy it. I kind of regret that now. I should have went ahead, because it was only like $5 more to buy it as opposed to rent it. And I should have went ahead and bought it. But I was like, I don't know. For some reason, I was just being tight-fisted today. But I'll probably end up going back and buying it. I enjoyed watching it. And I just, like you said, the Colin Farrell scenes were hilarious. And I liked the way that it was not just violence and F-bombs the whole way through. There was funny stuff thrown in there as well. So it brought a little, it just made it enjoyable for me.
All right, very good. So an 8 from you and an 8 from Robert. So I guess I get to be the naysayer. I enjoyed this film. I liked the witty dialogue and I liked the convoluted plot to a point, but I think it got a little over convoluted. And as we've discussed in this episode, some of the things don't quite make a whole lot of sense, or you kind of need to believe that really smart characters are actually really dumb, or at least really dumb in certain areas for it to kind of work. So for that, I'm going to have to give it a couple of demerits, but it is still a very entertaining film. And like I said, the dialogue is top notch, and it is a lot of fun. So I'm going to go with the 7.5, so not too much lower than you two. And I will also recommend Lock, Stock, and Snatch. And if you watch them all, you know, like within a short time frame, you'll kind of get how they all, not that they fit together per se, but like the genre or like the tone is very similar. And so you'll get your Guy Ritchie fix by doing that. So highly recommend all three of these films. And like Robert was saying, I don't know if this is as strong as the other two, but it is in the same vein and a nice return to form for Guy Ritchie.
Absolutely.
So
more of this. I would definitely watch another movie like this and get done by Guy Ritchie. This would be great.
Yeah, I had no idea that he was behind the abomination that was the Aladdin remake.
He's done a lot of crap in their meeting years. He's, you know, you got to make a paycheck. So, you know, you got to do what you got to do. So I've heard the storyline that you got to make, you know, one crap movie for the studio, and then they'll let you make your small indie project movie that you really care about. I don't know how true that is, but it kind of lends credence to the story that if you made Aladdin, then they'll let him make The Gentleman. I don't know. I'll take an Aladdin if I get a Gentleman. I'm not going to watch Aladdin, but I'll watch Gentleman.
Yeah, they probably made more money on the Aladdin one, though.
Oh, yeah, just, for sure.
It always blows me away. Like, sometimes these terrible movies make so much money. And these really good ones, these really fucking good ones, like, I mean, this one did well, you know, $115 million on $22 million. So it was no slouch, but you see it all the time.
Yeah, nowhere near the Disney movies money.
Oh, yeah, sure. It was horrible. I had sat with my coat over my head and played on my phone the whole time. I liked the animated version. So, I mean, I went in there with high hopes, I guess. Too high, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to beat Robin Williams. He's a one-of-a-kind guy. So anyway, this has been a really fun episode, Rachel. And so thank you again for joining us. Hope you can stick around for some of the bonus content available for Patreon supporters, lastnighters.com/Patreon. Also, people should check out your show, Cannabis Heals Me. The episode with Mark Thornton is episode 115. We'll have that on the show notes page. We'll also have Chasing the Scream, a link to that. If you send me an Audible link, I can post that on the show notes page because I think you'll get a small commission or some kind of bonus if people use that. And then I'll also put a Amazon link to the book on the show notes page as well. So everyone gets a little bit of, you know, pennies if anyone clicks on it. And Robert, next week, we're going to be doing another Disney film, musical.
Oh, no.
Hamilton.
Oh, no.
took Broadway by storm years ago, a couple of years ago, and now it's finally on Disney Plus. We both have access to that. I think it's like a 3-hour extravaganza.
So oh, no.
Strap yourself in. And we're going to be having a very well-informed guest. It's Tho Bishop of the Mises Institute, and he is a bit of a scholar on Hamilton. And we'll, of course, be referencing a lot of the libertarian takes on Hamilton. There was a very famous debate between Michael Malus and Tom Woods, whether Hamilton was a good guy or a bad guy. Yeah. And Woods
Champion
won.
Of Liberty, I think, was.
Yeah, and Woods won the argument, but I think Malus had some decent takes on it. And Kevin Gutzman has a really good article related to it, so I'll be sure to read that before we have that episode, and I'll put that on the show notes page, among other things. So that'll be what we're going to be doing next week. And people, check out Rachel's stuff. Check out our Patreon. Support us there. People have been doing that. People have been reaching out to us, like I said, at the end of one of our recent episodes, Robert. We're getting suggestions from people on Twitter, via email. We're getting comments. We're getting new subscribes on YouTube. We're getting some new Patreon patrons. Hey. So things are picking up. It's all really right. Good. So I'm appreciating that from people. It vindicates that we're not just two guys in a
shouting into the void.
Yeah, talking into the void. It's actually getting somewhere. So anyway, we really appreciate that. And with that, Robert, why don't you recommend how people can support us before we sign off and get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive bonus content?
Well, I can make a few suggestions about what you could do, but you may come up with more creative solutions. Don't let this be the end-all, be-all list. You can go to trepster.com and buy some merch. You can subscribe to us, like Daniel mentioned, on the YouTubes. You can talk about us. You can partake in the conversation by leaving us messages, emails, tweets, that sort of thing. You can tell friends about it. You can leave a review on the Apple Podcasts or whatever podcasting form your podcasting desires take. Yeah, I think that's all the ideas I have, other than the Patreons, of course. But yeah, don't let me stop you. Don't let my limited imagination stop you from exploring your creativity in ways to, if you like the content, mention it, talk about it.
Yeah.
And thanks in advance.
Don't let us like hold you back. And also another way you can help us is by visiting our friends and their websites. So cannabisheelsme.com, check it out. And check this one out at lastnighters.com/133. And also on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. And with that, we'll say goodnight from last night, everyone. Peace out. And we're back. All right. We're going to continue the Action Under Key podcast for another moment. I hope you guys can hear me. I just said a whole bunch of stuff for like 20 seconds, and the video feed has been freezing on me. Did you guys hear any of that, or is it just picked up now?
No, I just heard and we're back.
All right. Well, and we're back. Still talking the Action Under Key podcast for another minute. So I've saved a sort of like difficult question for this portion of the show. There were some reviews, some scathing reviews of The Gentleman claiming that it was Guy Ritchie's return to gangster movies is an angry, racist mess, 1 out of 5 stars. In truth, Ritchie's ultra-British gangster films have always walked a thin line between their Boys Will Be Boys flippancy and plain cruelty, but this is the angriest of them all. Being an equal opportunity offender doesn't magically excuse racism. Robert, did you see anything that would substantiate such a take?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. Yeah, you got your miserly Jewish character, you know? He's not going to pay $400 million. He's going to negotiate the price down to like $130 million. Yeah.
And he was gay, right? So like double whammy, double virtue points or whatever they're called.
Evil gay Jew, you know? Yeah, absolutely. And then you had that one scene in the gym where he's talking about being a black cunt. And then the other guy was like, he's not talking about all blacks are cunts. He's just talking about you.
Yeah, and I thought that was a great explanation of like the difference between a term of affection where you're ribbing somebody in jocularity or saying something that's actually offensive based on, you know, like racial differences or cultural differences, that is maybe more suspect.
Yeah. And the one character that got offended, was offended by it, was the stupid moron idiot character. So I thought that was pretty spot on.
Yeah. Now, do you think there was enough of that stuff in this film to like give us such a scathing review in the independent newspaper? Out of 5 stars.
Well, go ahead.
I didn't pick up on it, but maybe I'm just not sensitive enough to it. So I'm not looking to be offended.
You got some serious snowflakes around here writing movie reviews.
And they probably weren't real nice as far as, you know, comments that they made regarding the Asian mob. I mean, there were probably some derogatory comments made toward them, but I mean, they weren't casting aspersions to anyone. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I would think that would be normal conversation with people who are in gangs. They probably don't care about who they offend.
Right. It's like this reviewer has never seen Blazing Saddles or something. Like, if you want to be offended, but I mean, it's brilliantly funny in Blazing Saddles. And it's not like this is a white power film about like racial superiority or anything like that. Like, it seems like it's worlds away from what racism used to mean. Now it's just anything I don't like.
Yeah, it's anything you don't like. And it involves, it's funny, if there isn't any non-white characters, then it's a lack of representation. But then when you do have non-white characters that are flawed, then it's racist and problematic and every other thing. So you have to have these flawless, boring, unrealistic characters that are just stupid as hell, that no one would ever want to watch the damn movie in the first place. It's basically a bunch of morons telling professional storytellers how to write better stories when they have no clue what makes an interesting story.
But then if they do that, then it's pandering. So you can't win.
Yeah.
Or sometimes they'll insert these characters and it just feels contrived. I know when I watch movies and I'll see these characters that are women, I'm like, that's just, I'm insulted as a woman that they're sticking this character in just so they can maybe get some more female eyeballs. It's like, I would rather see a well-rounded character as opposed to some, you know, token character, some pity character that they're going to put in for me.
Right. Like, it should either advance the plot and be integral to the film itself, the story, or it should be a move that's going to make them more money. It shouldn't just be pandering to the outrage mob.
Right. I mean, I thought the thing with all the female mechanics in her shop, I thought that was, I'm like, really? Like, you're going to have a bunch of women in there doing that sweaty, dirty work, and they're sure as heck not going to look like that.
Yeah, those women all looked particularly well made up and not dirty at all.
Right. And yeah, they didn't look like they had a bunch of grease under their fingers, and they were like little petite women. It's like, okay, you know, you're going to pull a motor out of an engine. I mean, I guess you use tools and stuff, but it seemed silly to me to have a shop full of women. It's like, okay, what does this have to do with anything?
Yeah, is this wartime? Is this a Rosie the Riveter situation? I don't think so.
All right. Well, anyway, I just wanted to bring up that question. And we did go a little bit long on the other portion of the show, so we could probably cut this off here and actually get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive. So I'll just remind everyone that Cannabis Heals Me is the website for our guest, and episode 115 of that show is with Mark Thornton, which is the one that we were talking about earlier. The show notes for this particular episode will be found at actualnikki.com/190. And we will have Tho Bishop on next week talking about Hamilton. And that'll be doing it for us for this week. So thank you guys for joining us. We really appreciate having you as our listeners and YouTube viewers. And we'll be seeing you next week for Hamilton. And we'll say maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk.
We're the Chipmunks, guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.